So that's the extraordinary sound of Elliot Carter's Concerto for Orchestra. It's got one of the most exciting beginnings of any orchestral piece I can think of. If you were paying attention a few weeks ago, you will know that Elliot Carter died last month. He was 103 years old. He would have turned 104 last Tuesday. He was born in 1908 in New York, and he was a composer of neoclassical music in the 1930s when he was under the sway of the French pedagogue Nadia Boulanger. In the late 30s and early 1940s, he wrote sort of Americana, like his friend Aaron Copland. But then he really discovered himself right at the end of the 1940s. And the kind of music that we're hearing now was the result of that. Between 1951 and 1970, in those two decades, he produced just 8 major works, because it took him so long with all of those sketches involved to produce anything at all. But the older he got, the more productive he became, and after turning 90, he composed 50 pieces. I interviewed him last in 2006. I went to his apartment in Greenwich Village. He was 97 years old, and I was particularly interested to find out about this brand new productivity. I think the place I would like to begin is by asking you about the astonishing rate of production of your music in recent years. You're writing music faster now in your late 90s, it seems to me, or producing pieces faster than you did in middle age. Can you account for this?
Well, there's one basic thing, and that is that I felt in what you call my midlife, that I was always experimenting with all kinds of different kinds of harmony, different kinds of rhythm, different kinds of expression. And gradually I began to find what I really wanted to do and what I felt at a certain point I did not need to experiment anymore, to try out different kinds of things that I knew what I wanted to do. So it was very much easier to write pieces because I knew all ahead of time the kind of piece that I wanted to write, and I also believed that I could write it, which up to the fairly, well, maybe 15, 20 years ago, I was writing these large pieces that experimented in all kinds of different ways. And in some sense, because of that, my music has become what people say is simpler, but it's not so simple for me. And so it doesn't take me as long to write the pieces as I used to. And then, as one gets older, one gets impatient. And you want to finish a piece. You see, musicians are not like painters. You can't leave a piece unfinished, or you can, but it doesn't amount to anything unless somebody comes along and tries to fix it. There are Bach fugues, for instance, that people have tried to work out, but they don't succeed. And it's very hard with an individual composer for anybody to complete a work so that one feels that you have to complete the piece. And as a result, the pressure of this has also, I think, helped me to get pieces finished.
I remember there were hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of sketches for the Concerto for Orchestra in 1969, 1970. I assume you don't do that anymore.
I write an awful lot of sketches just the same. In that period, from about the second string quartet, which is, I think, around 1960, I did a great deal of sort of searching around to find out what I really wanted to do and what I really liked. After all, a composer from my time was trained and also was very familiar with the repertory of music and was trained about how to write harmony and how to write all those kinds of things, and to gradually discard all this and find out what it was you really wanted to do and not just have it repeat something that you'd already heard that had been done far better than you ever could. And as a result, the effort to do this took a terrible lot of work in the early days, because what automatically often came to my head was something that, well, you know, you might have heard it in Brahms, let's say, but I didn't, you know, there's an awful lot of things like that that just had to be discarded and sort of cleaned away in a certain sense. And I keep trying to find what it was that was most meaningful to me and most interesting to me. You see, one of the problems about writing music of any length is you have to be sure that it's interesting enough to keep you going till the end. And that's that was always a problem, and one of the many problems that I was confronted with at that time. I don't feel that way anymore very much.
You seem to be suggesting that the pieces like the second string quartet and the double concerto and the piano concerto and the concerto for orchestra, those works from the late 1950s to about 1970, were pieces in which you were discovering your own voice to some degree and that you've now found it. But I don't think anybody should be under the misapprehension that you now just cut off a few more yards of Carter every time you need to make a piece, because the pieces are strikingly different from each other still.
I hope so. What you're describing is really not exactly like the way it looked to me when I was writing those earlier pieces. In a certain sense, I had a feeling that I was as if I were in a desert, because of the music that I knew was not what I wanted to write, and that I was trying to find out what it was. And so, and you know, you discover a cactus here and a fox there and so forth. And that was the way it was. But it was always these people, this world of a certain kind that I was exploring. I was not exploring. I was just exploring what was my world of music. And that took time.
Perhaps we could talk about one or two of the recent pieces, because these are in no sense, you know, negligible works. These are big pieces, sort of 20-minute pieces, very often for full orchestra. Maybe we could talk about the Boston Concerto, which is a particular favourite of mine, and again, it's a piece that opens in a way that no other Elliott Carter piece has ever opened. It's completely unique start to a piece. Where did that come from?
Well, I think that I got very interested in using the notion of pizzicato, plucked strings. When I wrote my fifth quartet, which ends with a pizzicato section, a sort of ironic kind of thing, and I thought it would be interesting to write a big orchestra piece that used the notion of pizzicato very frequently. And then I began to think of how one could use this, and it's not consistently pizzicato. There are episodes that interrupt that, but the main idea itself keeps coming back, and it starts that way, and it ends with orchestra, somehow a whole section of the orchestra playing very short notes. It was an idea that came actually from thinking about the idea that I was always writing big legato pieces with the long lyrical lines, and I thought, well, it'd be interesting to write something that's all like a lot of little dots, all shaped out of the little dots of notes.
And presumably it's also related to the epigram, the beginning of the piece, the quotation from William Carlos Williams about rain.
Oh, well, that's only part of it. Let me say there was also a pizzicato number in my tempo, Tempi, my Italian songs, which was actually about enjoying oneself and suddenly feeling badly about it. It was like a dog howling in the night, something like that, as I remember the poem ends. But this was something that kept coming back to my mind, and I finally decided. Now, this particular piece was written in a very sad part of my life. My wife was very ill in the other room, and was obviously not going to be with me for very much longer. And so I wrote this piece while she was encouraging me, let us say, but I always thought that somehow this was like that, and I found this poem of William Carlos Williams that talked about rain, which after all is partly the sound of the pizzicato with a lot of little separate dots of sound. And it's a beautiful poem, which I'm sorry I cannot quote because I don't remember it precisely. But it was all about how rain makes everything come to life, which was, I felt, something I wanted to say to my wife.
The number of pieces that have been concerto-like recently in your output, Elliot Carter, is quite striking. We've talked about the Boston Concerto. There's a cello concerto that you composed for Yo-Yo Ma. There's a piano concerto in all but name in Dialogues. And now you're working on a horn concerto. And in the not-too-distant past, there were a violin concerto and an oboe concerto and a clarinet concerto. I don't know whether I've missed anything out. I fear I might have done. But it's something about the pitting of a soloist against a large group of instruments presumably appeals to you.
Of course, the notion of the solo against a large group of instruments came to me long ago when I wrote the piano concerto in Berlin. And it was in this atmosphere of, it was before the Berlin Wall was down, the idea of thinking about what had been happening there and some... made me realize or feel that the individual has a power and it must remain himself regardless of what the crowd does. And so I isolated, as I thought about it, the orchestra is a kind of crowd that is always trying to destroy the individual, but the individual with his soft voice finally ends and just as he began. Now, so this is the idea of isolating the orchestra from the soloist is one notion that persists pretty much in my pieces. It doesn't have the dramatic sense that one did. And then the next thing is that I began to think about the old concerto grosso that you have in Handel and in Bach, in which there is a group of main sections with the orchestra playing, whole orchestra playing, and then in between sections in which there were soloists of one kind or another. Brandenburg Concerto has done this rather consistently in most of them. And actually, I began to work this idea out more carefully in the clarinet concerto, in which I do actually have the orchestra divided into sections, a section of strings, a section of brass, and the clarinet in each one of these short sections in which it has an important solo, is, if it's possible, should go to the area where the brass are, plays his little piece for the brass, and then goes to the strings, so that he makes a tour of the whole thing. But in between each one of these, there is a full orchestra player. And I carried that on in various ways in all of my works after that time. Well, though I don't have people walking around anymore, but the horn concerto will be somewhat like that. There'll be a series of solo episodes with the horn playing with various kinds of instruments, and then big orchestral interludes between this. It seems to me it's an interesting idea. It has all kinds of meanings. For instance, in Dialogues, which does this in a different way, began to be, how does the piano relate to the orchestra, and what kind of a dialogue can it carry on? Sometimes it opposes the orchestra. It's at the very beginning of the dialogues. There's a sort of rather uncertain English horn solo, cor anglais solo, excuse me, and then the piano comes in with a great flourish, so that the two are immediately presented as being two entirely different types of character. This is carried on in many different ways throughout. Sometimes the piano interrupts the orchestra, or the other way around, the orchestra interrupts the piano. There are a whole series of different ideas about the relation of the orchestra to the soloist, which fascinated me.
Listening to you talk just then about the relationship between the soloist and the orchestra in Dialogues, the piece for piano and small orchestra, I was reminded of hearing you talk on I think this very couch about 15 years ago, the first time I came to visit you, about the characters in your string quartets and relating them to Mozart. You do think of your musical figures and musical instruments in a very human way. That's almost like a cast list, a dramatis personae.
Well, yes, I've certainly thought of it that way. I felt that particularly in the string quartets, the idea that we have four individuals, each of which has his own life and his own character, and here they are learning to play a piece and working on a piece and finally playing a piece in which we still know they're individuals, but they produce one unified effect. And so each of my quartets has dealt with this particular problem after the first one. The second, third, fourth, and fifth, each isolates or gives a character to each one of the players. And then the players react in various different ways to each other and to the idea they're doing a total effect. It seemed to me a sort of example of what we hope society would be like.
Yes, a sort of model of society, you could say. Perhaps we could talk about your early years. You were born in 1908, which is the very year that Schoenberg came out with his first quote unquote atonal piece. So you were born, as it were, into musical modernity. Did you always feel a part of what came to be called modernism?
Well, let me say that as far as I'm concerned, modernism is not a style which will stop. It will be like the Renaissance. It will continue as itself. It's new. Its way of thinking about music, which will remain and be discovered in many different ways. I mean, I've tried in my little way to carry on some of the ideas that the modernists of the of that early period before the First World War to try to find certain things, new ways of using that they hadn't. But I was born, and I have to say that the reason that I became a composer was on hearing the writer Spring of Stravinsky, and I decided after that I'd be a composer, which was when I was maybe 16 or 17. And I knew at that time a lot of people. I knew Edgar Varèse, who lives down here not far from us now, did live, and I knew Charles Ives in those years. I had a teacher that introduced me to these people. And it was a whole world of very exciting modernism in the 20s that I grew up in, that remained an important part of my life from that time on. I was a member. First, I was at Harvard University, and there was a small group of us that were very interested in modern music. One of them was Lincoln Kirstein, who started the New York City Ballet, and another one was, I don't remember his name, who started the Museum of Modern Art. There were a whole group of them that were sort of the founders of the important parts of the modern movement in the United States. And I felt that I've stuck with that all the way through. I mean, it's not, and it was, of course, in the early days, it was something that people did not, the general public did not like and was not terribly interested in, but then it gradually, in certain fields, certainly in painting, began to take over very much. And even now people are willing to pay more for modern pictures than they are for old ones.
Modernism, of course, was an international movement, but here in New York City, it seems to me that in both the visual arts and to a certain extent in music, there was specifically American, perhaps even specifically New York, attitudes to modernism. Did you feel that you were a New York composer in any sense?
I can't say I feel that I was a New York composer. I don't feel that I am any kind of composer. I'm just me. I'm just myself. And there are so many aspects of my own particular life that isolates me, actually, from being what you might call a New York composer. My father was an importer from France, so that when I was a child, I was taught French. And France was always an important part of my culture. I've never been quite sure what I thought about France. I've always admired certain aspects of it and rather angry at others. But I've had this as an important part of my life. And even Great Britain has been, in England has been, in London and has been very important. These are all things that I traveled a good deal with my father when I was very young, and so I've been to all kinds of places, even to Italy, and the terrible period in Germany when the mark was devaluated to almost nothing. I've been all around all that. I've always lived in this sort of maybe a little non-New York period life of my own, but New York, I've always thought maybe I'd move to London because contemporary music was a little more lively. I was a great friend of Sir William Glock. And then anyhow, I like it better here, I think.
There's something about this city, I must say, and your music that do go together very well. I mean, the city is always changing. I mean, I remember vividly the first time I came to visit you and Helen, your late wife, showing me the view from your window of the World Trade Center towers, for instance. So,
no, it's not here.
Which is not there anymore, of course. No. But
we saw it. We could see the catastrophe from the window.
You watched it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was watched. Look, I never watch anything. I was composing in the other room, and somebody called up and said, "You better look out the window," and that's how I happened to see it.
But the other thing about New York is its modernity seems to me to be very much a 1920s and 30s modernity. I suppose I'm thinking of the architecture as much as anything. You look around this city and you see something which is very strikingly of its time, a sort of deco modernism. I don't know whether that means anything to your music.
Well, Gertrude Stein, an impossible writer, wrote that New York was the oldest new city. And in some sense, this is true, so that it remains, unlike, let us say, a city like Minneapolis, which is filled with modern buildings, and there's many of them by very good architecture. But here, you know, we make do with many old pieces, and it's a sort of symbol of a kind of weird kind of democracy. Each building has its own character, and finally there's streets. In some ways, of course, Paris with the Haussmann boulevards is all that was ironed away during the time of Napoleon III. I must say that I like that. But still, I'm still fond of this city too, but in an entirely different way.
I think talking about New York in this sense of it being a kind of patchwork of individual moments leads us quite nicely to discuss Mosaic, which is a piece which is shortly to have its Australian premiere. Perhaps we could talk about this piece because the title is carefully chosen, I think. It's a mosaic, among other things, of harp techniques, isn't it?
I'm afraid you're right. I was a great friend early on. There was a modern music society when I was very young, of which Varese and Charles Ives and the harpist Carlos Salcedo were members, and they ran the thing. And I knew Carlos Salcedo quite well, and he did many used many new techniques for the harp, all kinds of different sorts of things, and so. When I was commissioned by the National Ensemble in London to write a piece for them, I found out they had a good harpist, and I thought I would like to write a piece in memory of Carlos Salcedo. And so I used in the piece many of the things that Carlos had discovered or had devised in the harp. So this is a mosaic of many harp techniques, but. That's only a minor part of it. I mean, the main part is, again, the same thing we've said about a harp concerti. It's only, I don't remember how many instruments. I think they're eight or so instruments along with the harp. And they are contrasting. The instruments do different things in the harp. The harp has its own kind of development throughout the piece, and the others have an entirely different development and a different way of playing and different speeds and all sorts of things. I'm an inveterate person dealing with this particular problem. I always do it, and if I don't do it, I don't like it.
You mean you always compose, and if you don't compose, you don't like it?
Well, I always compose these particular problems with rhythmic, unusual rhythms and unusual contrasts. I know that if I didn't do that, I wouldn't like it.
Well, perhaps we could talk a little bit about the metrical side of that, because your name is linked to this fearsome sounding a musical device, metrical modulation, but in actual fact it's a device which, if you don't quite know what it is, you might not even know it was there. You're just aware that the music keeps sort of changing speed without you really noticing how it's happened.
Well, what people have called metric modulation is a rather simple device, and it's not exactly new at all. I think that there's a series of variations in one of the last Beethoven piano sonatas, in which each variation uses one of the units of the previous variation and develops a speed from that unit, which is different from the previous. He has them all different speeds, but they're all interconnected because they have a similar unit. And I realized what I began to feel as I began to take composing seriously, and particularly around the beginning of the Second World War, that the people that started modernism had not really come to grips with many rhythmic problems, which actually I knew. One of the composers, for instance, that did interest me when I was very young is Scriabin, who did do a good many experiments with rhythm. And it was largely thinking about his music at that time, long ago, that I began to think of how could one develop this into various systems in various ways. Now, my first string quartet was one of the first pieces which I developed this in an extremely elaborate way, and I treated each speed as if it were like a key in old music, and so that the beginning speed is the same as the end speed, and in between there are all these modulations that go from one speed to another, and they all do it, as you say, smoothly, so you don't hear that, don't realize that it's playing at a different speed until after it's happened, and because I've fixed it so that they're all joined together like the way you do in a modulation in harmony.
Yeah, Oliver Nussen, I think, said it was like a big synchromesh gearbox where you can go from one gear to another very smoothly.
Yes, that's right.
It's surprising in a way, isn't it, since music is an art that must be played out in time, that composers before you hadn't been more interested in the business of how the music works in time and how you can control time in the same way that you would control harmony.
I don't know that. I think that, of course, there are several sorts of things that music was dominated by due to the way people lived. One of them was regular dance rhythms. Another one was marching rhythms. And then we had all those horses that marched along. All of that's disappeared. And we now fly along in an airplane or take an automobile. I mean, the rhythm of our lives is entirely different in background than it was even in the late 19th century. So that was another thing I've thought a lot about, that we are living in this continual change and smooth changes from one thing to another. And this was something that interested me a good deal, and I've tried at different times to match that, to match the experience that one has about it.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National, and I'm talking to Elliot Carter in his apartment in New York City. I'd like to ask you a little bit about your relationship with poets, with poetry, because particularly since 1975, when you composed A Mirror on Which to Dwell, the Elizabeth Bishop song cycle, you've returned to the voice. And perhaps I should say that in the 30-something years leading up to 1975, you'd composed no vocal music at all. So your interaction with text at a literal level, actually setting words, is a relatively recent thing again. But Elizabeth Bishop, John Ashbery, Robert Lowell, William Carlos Williams, and now Wallace Stevens, who interests me a lot. Perhaps you could talk about how you choose your poets, or do they, as it were, choose you?
Well, I mean, how I chose, for instance, Elizabeth Bishop to begin with, was that I was commissioned to write a vocal piece by a small group called Specula Musicae. And I was a great friend of Robert Lowell, and I said to him that I would like to write something for woman's voice, and I'd like to have it a poet that is female, that would write as if when the singer was singing something that was directly connected to her. And he suggested Elizabeth Bishop, and I read a lot of her poetry. And I found that most of it I could not set. They were long and having many varied things. So I had to choose what seemed to me very short and very pointed. Each thing that I chose had a specific point and stuck to it rather intensively, so that one could keep in a certain character throughout with a particular song. And my choice has always been to try and have the poem follow, so to speak, a kind of musical development that if it was too diffuse and too varied and too, it would be much more difficult and nearly impossible for me to set. Thank you.
I've been, I only picked it up a couple of days ago, so I haven't got very far, but I've been making a little bit of headway with Edward Said's book on late style. I don't know whether you've come across this yet. It's just been published.
On
late style, and he talks about late Beethoven, and he talks...
Oh, yeah, what people did in their old age.
And it seems to me that probably there is no major composer in history who has had such a late style as you. I just wonder whether you're conscious of having a style at all, let alone a late style.
I can't say that I think about style as a style. I mean, I just simply write what I think I would like to hear without thinking about how it fits into the history of things or how it's related to other pieces. So that I can't say that there's a style, a consciously thought out style at all. I suppose my late style is what we were saying earlier on, that it's more a kind of condensation of all the things that I'd been thinking about in previous times. In fact, for instance, the fifth quartet is an example of what I'm saying, that it's dramatized as if it were a rehearsal. And when the instruments all play separate little pieces, and then finally they get together and play something that's like a movement of a string quartet, and they do that, I think, four times, and each one is a little reminiscence of each one of my string quartets. But they keep falling apart, and it's just like, just as if it were a rehearsal.
I should ask you, because I realize that I think I'm exactly half your age, and yet I don't seem to have anything like the degree of musical fecundity that you have. I'm certainly not making pieces at the rate at which you manage to make them. So there's that side of it. And also, I dare say there will be some people listening to this interview who are themselves in their 90s and will not be as active as you. And I just wondered whether you could tell us a bit about your schedule. I mean, how do you fit it in?
People always ask me about this, but you see, I don't really feel that I'm old or young, and what I feel is that now there are some things that I don't do as well as I used to. I can't walk for so far, and I'm a little dizzy when I try to go down a large flight of stairs. But as far as sitting down here, I feel just like a young man. I mean, it's just that there are physical things that are different from when I was younger, but the actual thing that goes on in my head doesn't seem to be, as far as I can tell, it doesn't seem to be any different. I know I see people of my age who can hardly talk or can't remember anything or all that. I've just been fortunate. I really don't know why. Both my mother and father died of cancer at a much earlier age than I am. So that it's a mystery. It's just luck. I don't know whether it's luck or maybe disaster, too.
No, I think it's great good fortune. And I wish you more of it. But we should stop. But we talked earlier about the way you begin pieces, and they're always striking, and equally striking is the way in which you end pieces. So I thought maybe in order to finish this interview, we should hear the ending of one of your pieces at any rate. What's your current favourite?
My current favourite of ending? Well, I don't know. Charles Rosen says that my music always ends softly. But there are a couple of them that end quite loud. No, I can't honestly say this. The favorite example of this kind of thing is the last song of Tempoi Tempi, the secret of the poet. And that starts with the poet in darkness, and finally light shines, and I have the singer sing Luce, a note. Now, that's one way of ending.
Well, that's how we'll end this interview. Elliot Carter, thank you very much indeed for talking to me on The Music Show.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mr. Ford.